Hi, I'm Matt Alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 4th of 1987. My home group is the Magnolia Speakers Meeting in Seattle. We're Friday night at 8 o'clock. A couple people in this room I know have spoken at that meeting. About the same amount of people would be here. So if you're ever in Seattle on a Friday night, please come out and see us. We're in Magnolia. It's easy to find. My sponsor is actually Kenny D. I couldn't say no, right? No, just joking. Those of you that know Kenny, you'll kind of know the difference between Kenny and I. But if you don't know the difference between Kenny and I, if you don't know him, I can kind of give it to you in a quick snapshot. All right, so you have to kind of envision what's going on here. Kenny's in the driver's seat. I'm in the passenger seat. I've got a sponsee in the back, and we got a newcomer in the back together. We're driving from Seattle to Olympia to go to a gratitude event. And we're driving along, and there's a van kind of driving crazy in front of us, shooting between cars, kind of goes out of control, hits an SUV. The SUV spins. The trunk of the van, the tailgate opens up, stuff falls out. And the van kind of takes off, and the SUV's pointing back at us, kind of up against a guardrail. This happens, 300 feet in front of us or something like that. So we see the whole thing happening. Now, these things are said at the exact same time, from Kenny in the driver's seat and me in the passenger seat. Kenny in the driver's seat, and Brendan D does the best Kenny impersonation. I don't think I probably do that great a job, but I'll try to do it as closely as possible. We should see if those people are all right. At the exact same time, I'm saying, get that guy! Right? And that's a perfect snapshot of the difference between me and Kenny. Right? As soon as I said that at the exact same time, I'm like, oh yeah, right. We need to check on these people and make sure they're okay. Now, the two newcomers in the back were with me, on my decision, but Kenny was doing the right thing there. So that's a good idea, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to my program and so forth. So I'm going to give you a little bit of family history. My family goes back to the Mayflower. We're also Cherokee. But we have people that have been in this country for a very, very long time. But I'll give you a snapshot of a couple of people who are really meaningful with regards to our disease. The first one's on my mother's side. Ezekiel Harlan was brought over with the first group to develop the first Quaker society in America. And, if you go back to that area of Pennsylvania, you'll see historic landmark homes that were built by, with our name on it, with our family name on it. And he was there, his kid, and they were, they were royalty of the Quakers, right? His kid, same thing, stuck right with it. Now the next kid, Ellis Harlan, didn't kind of fall in line. And there's, in the official Quaker record, there's the information of why they kicked Ellis out of the Quakers. And I'm going to paraphrase it because it sounds a little funnier if I paraphrase it. Basically, because he was not willing to turn his will and his life over to his higher power, who would have saved him from his evil ways, he proceeded to drink strong liquor and fight with many people. And therefore, we are kicking you out of the Quakers, all right? And again, you can go, it's in the official Quaker record. Now, that's my mom's side of the family. My dad's side of the family, one of our relatives is having some problems in Albany, New York, and kind of ran afoul of the law. A couple of guys went and intervened, said, hey, we have a way that this guy cannot cause a lot of problems. And the judge says, okay, go for it, right? And they start talking to the guy. They bring him to Sam Shoemaker's church. Sam Shoemaker tells him all his stuff. That guy then goes and visits his friend Bill Wilson. And he says, hey, Bill, this thing's working for me, you know, and I found God, and it's keeping me sober. And Bill goes, I kind of believe it, you know, but Bill's not really ready for it yet, all right? Then Bill goes off. He ends up back in town's hospital. Abby goes, sees him, you know, and they start doing, you know, the steps of the versions that they had at that time. You know, now you would think that my family would have embraced that history, right? But I didn't know about it. I stumbled upon it when I was doing family research, right? And the reason, and a good illustration of why that's the case, is that Tom Thatcher, who was Ebby's brother, when they were trying to figure out, okay, how do we put this thing together, right? How do we kind of, you know, before there was a book, before, you know, when they're doing a whole system of, okay, how do we market this thing so we can get these guys to pay us a bunch of money so that we can build this thing that we want to try to build? And Tom Thatcher met with Bill and some people, and he wrote up a plan and said, this is what you should do. He said, and he crossed out alcoholics. He said, don't do that. Call it Victors Anonymous. Right? And that's what happened with my family. Right? The shame of alcoholism kept everybody quiet. And that generation of Thatchers, my great grandfather was in that generation of Thatchers in Albany, and he came out to California to chase Walter Hagen, you know? Did the same thing, just exactly like Bill. Came out to California, got involved with a group of people, they were gonna build Riviera Country Club, and in his 40s, he just dropped dead from alcoholism, you know? And then, the little thing came out about all these uncles. You know, that entire generation of Thatchers, you know, a lot of them died of this disease, right? And how this carried down into my specific family is, you know, my mom, alcoholic, and she, who's a sad alcoholic here? Come on, raise your hands if you're a sad alcoholic. You know if you are, right? Okay, so my mom's a sad alcoholic. She's a fun alcoholic and then a sad alcoholic, right? And, you know, as a sad alcoholic, what that looked like, you know, my parents had split up and, you know, I was living with my mom and my brother and I were living with my mom, and she would, she drank like a 24-ounce tumbler, you know, plastic cup. Right? That's what she drank out of. You know, disc, it was like the yellow one, but it wasn't really yellow anymore. And it was, it always had some form of Gallo wine. All right? And it's not good wine if you don't know what that is. I mean, if you're too young, it's not good wine. It was either the Chablis or the Hardy Burgundy. She kind of went back and forth. But she'd start drinking. And then every now and then, she'd call me out of my room, and she'd play some folk music song. And it was always about some mother and their child. And like, we were supposed to be having our moment, right? And that's exactly what it looked like. And so she was the kind of fun drunk who turned sad drunk. My dad was a fun drunk who turned angry drunk. Now, nothing like Al's dad, you know. He was not physically, neither of my parents ever physically abused me or really ever even raged at me, you know, with their alcoholism. But my dad would just get, like, irritable and, you know, and angry. And, you know, and one time, as far as it ever went, is he was a USC football fan, and USC was playing UCLA. Jeff Fisher, who ended up being coach for the Rams and other football teams, was playing defensive back for USC. They were in the lead. He went up to make an interception and jumped just a little too early. The ball tips off his hands. I think a guy named Freeman McNeil catches it and runs for a long touchdown. And it was the end of the game. They were losing the game. And my dad had been drinking a lot. And my stepmother said something that fired him up. And he went after her, you know. And I'd never seen him get physical at all. And he went after her. And, you know, and I, luckily at the time, I was as big as he was, you know. And I got him off, you know, in a headlock and whatever, you know. Now, she was a good undertreated codependent, all right. Not an Al-Anon. I'm not saying anything about Al-Anon. She was not an Al-Anon. She was an untreated codependent. So as soon as I got him kind of in the headlock, she just went straight at him, right? You think you can do it? And I was like, stop, you know. But that's, you know, that's what it looked like. I mean, that's what it looked like in, you know, in my life. Kenny, because, you know, he's not here, and he, you know, he suggested I be here. He likes me to tell this specific part. He said, every time you talk, you should talk about that. And I said, okay, Kenny, I'll talk about that. So, and what that is, you know, when Bill sent his story to the editor, not when it was in the multilith copy, but when it first went to the editor, it had 7 paragraphs that the editor just chopped right off the front of Bill's story. Right. Now, Bill's talked about those issues in those 7 paragraphs in a lot of different places, right? But really, the story is that, you know, when he was young, after he had basically gone and lived with his, he was living with his grandparents, you know, and he was going to the same school he was going to with Ebby. You know, he goes to that school and he, you know, says, you know, I'm going to work really hard and get good at baseball, right? And becomes the captain of the baseball team. And then he says, you know, I'm going to work really hard, and I'm going to be able to learn how to play the fiddle. And he learns how to play the fiddle and leads a little orchestra at the school. And then he says, you know, and then he becomes president of his class. And he talks about the story in a lot of different ways. One thing he says, he talks about it from the sense of being, you know, the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. He was below everybody, so he had to try to be above everybody. So he talks about that sometimes. He talks about, hey, everything went bad when his girlfriend died, right? The girlfriend was the minister's daughter, and she just like died one day, and they just announced it at the school, right? So he talks about these kinds of things. But the key about it for me, when I read that history, is that he becomes the head of the baseball team and stops playing baseball. Right, he becomes the fiddler, stops fiddling. He becomes the senior president, and doesn't graduate. You know, and that looks like exactly what my story looks like. You know, when I was young, I do not remember doing it. I don't remember any type of situation, but in some way, I took an IQ test. And that IQ test came at a number which put me into a special program in the California State Schools called Mentally Gifted Minors. Right? It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. You can look it up. You can Google it. They killed the program in 1980 because it was probably a really bad idea. But what they did was they said, you guys are special. And the number that they set was the same number they set for Mensa, for being in this program with a certain IQ. And so I am there. I have all the resources I could possibly need. You know, I'm an academic success story. I start having success in sports. right? So I, you know, break records in track in junior high school. I get to high school, I start football. And at the end of my high school year, my first year in high school, I get to go to Europe and play soccer. Right? So I have all of the things, you know, everything you could possibly, I don't have any type of life that looks like, hey, this person shouldn't be all good. But by my sophomore year, I wasn't playing football. I wasn't playing soccer. I wasn't running track. And I basically failed out of school. You know? And when I read Bill's story, and the thing that we do have in the story is, he goes to law school. And Bill was basically one test away from finishing law school. He finished the class and just never took the test. You know, and we're not, he says law course, so you think it's a class. It's law school. It's a number of classes, all right? And he just doesn't finish. He goes, nope, because Wall Street's doing it. He gets a job on Wall Street, and we all know he bails a job almost instantly. He goes, no, let's get in the motorcycle with the sidecar, all right? And, you know, understanding that thing with Bill, right, is the same thing for me, and it's that stuff that is supposed to be like the stuff that we all want doesn't pay off for me. You know, it doesn't pay off. It has nothing, has no value. It doesn't do the thing it's supposed to do. So it's got to be something else. It's got to be the next thing. It's got to be the next thing. And, you know, I had toyed around with stuff, pretty extensively by the time I went to England. But when I got to England, I could walk into a bar, a pub, I guess, and I could order whatever I wanted to order. Nobody asked any questions. I was 15 years old, right? Going into the pub every night and drinking until it closed. And, you know, I was staying with a family there, and you know, they didn't really have any control over me or anything. They couldn't, like, they weren't parenting me. They were basically providing me with a room. And they had provided me with a room, and they knew the Yank liked to take showers. So they actually they took a closet, plumbed it, and built a shower in it, and they had a little sink in there, too. Now, one night, I eat some Chinese food. Now, first of all, back in the day, this was early 80s, eating Chinese food in London was kind of adventurous, just as it was. It was not a good idea. I think it's different. I think it's much different now, but back in the day, it was not a good idea. So I do that and then go to the pub, drink all night, wake up in the middle of the night, and the room's spinning, you know, and I'm going, okay, this food's not staying down. So I run to the bathroom, and it's not really a bathroom. It's a shower, you know, and there's nothing I can do, right? Let it go right there. And try to wash the stuff down, and it's not going down the shower thing, right? So I had bought a pair of soccer cleats, and I took the bag on the outside of the soccer cleat box, scooped all the stuff into it, put it back in, you know, put it in the bag, tied it up, put it back in the box. And I was there for like maybe another month. And when I left, I had not gotten rid of that box. Now, my drinking, I'll be honest with you, I never had a good stomach. I never had a good stomach. I know that I didn't hear Paul yesterday, but supposedly there was some talk about sharding. And they said, I have to match the sharding talk. And I'm like, I don't know what to do about that. But so I didn't shart, but I sharfed a lot. because I never stopped getting sick. My stomach never got strong. By the time I was done drinking, when I drank in bars, the only thing I could drink was Bloody Marys because it's the only thing that would like stay down for any amount of time because my stomach just started rejecting it quick. And so, you know, so I come back from England. I'm a full-fledged, 100%, like, daily drinker. I try to get back into school, right? I try to do it, but it's like there's just no shot. So I kind of stumbling through. Now, I'm still going. I'm showing up. But as soon as I get there, I'm finding somebody to go take off and, you know, and drink with. And I do that, you know, through that time. And at that point, things are going pretty bad for my mom in Southern California. She hooks up with this guy and she's like, we're going to move. And we're going to move in with this guy. And so I'm like, okay. And they give me a piece of paper at the school. I tell the school I'm leaving, I'm moving to another place. They give me a piece of paper to take to my teachers and have them fill out what my grade is in their class. I haven't gone to class for like the entire year, right? So I'm like, okay. So I forge it, of course, right? And I take it to the new school and take it to the teachers, and they're like, okay, you know, and they're writing it in. I mean, nobody questioned me at all. They just were like, okay. Now, you know how you fill out the 20 questions and you fudge the questions? You talk to your doctor and you fudge your stuff, you're talking to your doctor and so forth, right? But you know you need to say something. You can't just, like, leave, you know. So one of my classes, I put that at a D, and I thought, well, it's passing. It's good. I go to the teacher looks at me like, I don't know how you're going to pass my class if you're coming in almost at the end of the year with a D. And I was like, blew that one, you know? But you know what? I did fine. And you know why I did fine? Because I didn't know anybody. I was in a new place. I didn't know how to get anything, right? And that happens with us, right? If you give us a little bit of time without any of the stuff that we use, right, we can actually do okay. So I do fine, and I'm eligible for sports again. So this is my junior year, I moved to a place where I was in a four-year high school first, and I moved to a three-year high school the next time. So I can play sports. So I joined the football team and get all-league recognition, all right? I'm thinking everything's going to be okay, you know, but guess what? Doesn't work again. Doesn't work. Doesn't make me go, yeah, I want to be like this. This is it. I'm going to do this, and it's going to be great. You know, it was like, I was at the award ceremony, and they gave me my thing, and I was like, is that all there is, right? There's that old Peggy Lee song, you know? And that's what it was, is that all there is? Because it doesn't pay off. But by that point, I had found the people who would be able to get me access to the stuff I need to get access to, all right? And that was it. That was the end of my high school. You know, it was the end of my high school career. And, you know, so I started off with promise, you know, and it was very clearly laid out promise. And, you know, and I was up there living with my mom, and she was living with this, the biker guy with the Moto Guzzi. He was also into retail sales. The same kind of retail sales Johnny was talking about. And there was byproduct from that retail sale that you can't sell. So he'd give me the byproduct, all right? Trash bags full of byproduct, you know? So I just sat in my room and did that, you know? And then because I had that kind of stuff, then I could go to people who actually had some money so we could get booze, right? And that's kind of what it was until things got really bad in that household, and, you know, and my mom's like, you gotta find somebody you can live with for a little bit. You know, find it, if you can find like a friend you can live with for a little bit, I'm gonna go to Hawaii, and then you guys can come live with me for a little bit in Hawaii. And so we proposed this to somebody like it's real. All right. I thought it was real. I thought for sure it was real, you know, but I'll tell you, before, and a spoiler alert, my mom gets sober. But before my mom got sober, the one thing I could say about her is the one thing you could rely on is that you could not rely on her. Right? And so it was that kind of thing. And so I'm thinking that's going to be a thing. This family lets me move in with them for a while, and I rob them blind, right, when I'm there, because they've got resources. They would, I don't know why they would do it, but they would go get a bunch of money and line it up on their dresser. Like, why would you do that, you know? And so, you know, I just go boop, 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 you know, and jewelry and other things, that kind of stuff. And my mom obviously never ends up going to Hawaii. And I'm like, okay, you know. And so I start, you know, I start basically, you know, having unofficial addresses. You know, because I was 18 years old. Nobody wanted me, you know. These families were like, no, 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 that guy is not coming anywhere near us. You know, so I start having unofficial addresses. And, you know, and whether it's a couch or whether it's, you know, a building that's not quite finished that I can, you know, kind of hang out in until, you know, for the night until workers are going to show up in the morning, whatever the case might be. And then every now and then I'd find a place, you know, where they, you know, maybe struggling a little bit to get renters and aren't going to kind of look at anything and maybe let you move in without having, you know, any money to start in with a down payment or whatever. And there's some of those places back in the day in Los Angeles. And, you know, and I start doing that, but I'm still kind of hanging out with people, and I still have, my mom still thinks this one address is where I'm staying. And one day a letter comes to me there. And, you know, my friend contacts me and goes, hey, there's a letter for you. And I go over there, and picture this. It's me and about six other, you know, juvenile delinquents, or, you know, young adult delinquents. And we're all getting drunk in somebody's backyard. And I get this letter, and I start opening it up, and it's got, you know, it's got multiple pages. And I start reading it, and I'm reading it, reading a page and passing it down the line. Right, and it was my mom's ninth step letter to me. Now, if any of you are thinking, I'll send a letter, you might want to rethink that idea. Because I don't know what it is. I don't know what any of that stuff is. I don't know that it's like a really meaningful act, you know? All I know is like, this is some messed up stuff. And I'm going to get some validation from these people. And they're like, oh, dude, man, I didn't realize it was that bad. You know, I didn't realize, oh, now wonder why you're like you are. Right. Here, have some more of this, you know. And, you know, and I didn't have any kind of great, you know, oh, this is an amazing thing and so forth. Now, we're in the same city. She could have got me face to face. And she's admitted since that time that she was not working with a sponsor. She did this one on her own, right? I'm sure a sponsor would be like, nah, you're going to go talk to him face by face, face to face. And maybe there might be a little bit of extra stuff in there that doesn't need to be in that letter. But it did open the door, right? And there was one point where I could not find another place to be that I felt, you know, was at all safe. You know, I mean, nowadays in Seattle, I could pitch a tent and I'd be good. You know, back in those days, you couldn't pitch a tent, you know? And so at one point I did, I contacted her and I said, hey, can I come stay with you for a little bit? And I met up with her, and she, you know, she realized, oh, this isn't a little bit. But she didn't say anything about that, but she kind of knew it, right? And, I mean, from the very first, you know, like we say, when we see somebody get sober, when we see somebody hit sobriety, right, and we see their eyes change, and we see their behavior change, and we see everything about them change, right, that was what I saw from her. All right, I saw Alcoholics Anonymous working. Now, I wasn't like, hey, I'm going to get sober now. This is awesome, right? But I saw that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. And, you know, and she would, when she got a year sober, she asked me to come to a meeting. She was, they do cakes in California, in Los Angeles. She was getting a cake. And, you know, and would I come to a meeting and, you know, watch her get a cake? And I was like, sure. And I don't know if she invited me to this one meeting on purpose, but it was ritzy. I mean, it was like, the buffet was like the Mirage, you know? I mean, you could eat well there, right? I made a plate, you know, sat down. The person who got up and talked was top of the line comic quality. Funny as all get out. Anybody would have enjoyed listening to this guy tell his story, right? And that made me go, you know, A's not a bad place to be. You know, A's not a bad place to be. The last time I went to jail, so I was a jail drunk. I was not a prison drunk, but I went to jail a number of times. The last time I went to jail, I went to jail on someone else's drunk driving arrest. And I'll tell you what the story was. I'm in the back. I'm in my house, and somebody's walking around. I'm in an apartment with my roommate, and someone's walking around out, you know, outside. And we're like, "Hey, who are you?" And we start talking to this person. And you know, she goes, "Hey," do you, and it's, you know, comes in and starts doing, you know, what we have. And then she asks if we could get a certain kind of drug. And I said, "But yeah, I know where we can get that." So she goes, "I'll pay for it if you do." And we're like, "Okay, let's go." So we get in the car. My friend's driving. She's in the driver's seat. I'm in the back seat, and I'm directing them. I direct them to the first place I know, and that guy's not there. So I'm like, "Okay, well, we got to go to this other guy's place." They start driving. I brown out. I come to, and we're really far away from where we were. I'm like, "Oh, okay, you have to go make a right here," and they start looping back around. They realize kind of what's going on. But I said, no, I'm good. I brown out again, and my roommate drives through three red lights and gets pulled over. So he gets pulled over. He basically falls out of the car. So they're like, "Okay, you're coming with us." And they say, and I know at this point I've got warrants out, a good number of warrants out for me. So I stash my wallet down in the back seat, so I'm not going to get caught. And they search the car and find my wallet, and they look at it. They're like, "Actually, we're more interested in you than we are even of this guy." So we both go in, and you know, and I spend the night in jail. I get up the next morning. I go in the holding cell, and I'm kind of in there. I'm like, "I've been through this thing again," but I'm thinking this time might be a little bit more serious. I haven't done anything, and I go to make a call. Now, the guy controlling the call is a guy named Psycho Mike. And the reason I know he's Psycho Mike is because on the end of the wall of this holding cell, there's a mural that he has done that is a picture of him with a thing across him that says, "Psycho Mike." And Psycho Mike basically was, you know, an institutionalized dude, but he was holding cell institutionalized. He knew how to get just enough so he'd end up in the holding cell, maybe go to city, but he's not going to go into prison. And he had got out the day before. He had gone home. He hogtied his neighbor while his neighbor was eating lunch. He ate his neighbor's lunch, went back to his house, and went to sleep. You know, and then boom, boom, boom. "Mike, come on out." He came on out and went back there. So he's controlling the phone, and he's a big dude, and there's nobody who's going to fight with Psycho Mike. So I go up to him, and I'm like, "Psycho Mike?" He goes, "What do you need?" And I said, I think I need to call somebody." He goes, "What do you need? Who are you going to call?" I said, "Well, I think I need to call somebody, you know, get me out of here." And he goes, "What are you in here for?" And I told him. I said, "Well, I've got a lot of warrants." He goes, "You don't need to call anybody." And I'm like, I couldn't really argue with Psycho Mike, but I kind of just stood there. He goes, "I'll tell you what's going to happen. A guy's going to come in a couple hours. He's going to say he's assistant DA so-and-so. He's going to ask you how long you've been here. You're going to say 2 days. And he's going to say time served, and you're going home." And I'm going, "Okay." And that exact thing happened, all right? Now, I had thousands of dollars worth of warrants, and they were wiped. right? Now, you think it's a great story, but it's just an illustration of the story of what my life had turned into, right? It had turned into having a set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes that we get out there doing our stuff, right? If I stole something, it was fine as long as I didn't get caught, right? There was nothing wrong with that. If I got caught, it's my fault. If I run from the cops and I get away, it's good because I got away, right? And that's the kind of mindset I had because I learned how to work that way through people like Psycho Mike. Now, what happened is I got an opportunity to take over this little shacky house, and I took over that little shacky house, and my I wasn't going to be able to pay rent. But basically, the two guys that were there had to bail, and they said, "Will you take over our lease?" And well, I'm like, "Yeah." I wasn't going to be able to pay the lease, so I knew it'd be probably 3 months, and I'd be out of it. My brother calls me though and says, "Can I move in with you?" And he goes, "My marriage is breaking up. Can I move in with you?" And that was sometime in December and in September, mid September of 1987, and by mid November of 1987, I walked in the door, and he looked at me. He goes, "I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to start going to AA." And I said, "I'll go too." Right. Now, would have been great if we actually went to AA. We drove up to AA, we looked at AA, we went, and we left AA. And so December 3rd of 1987, we're at a concert. The Replacements is the band. They're a classic drunk band. We're in line between the warm-up band and the headliners to buy Coke, Coca-Cola. And by the time we get to the front of the line, we're buying beer, right? Because we have no defense against that drink. Now, it was not like a great burn it down, all right, last party. It was one watered-down concert beer, that was no joy in it whatsoever. All right. And on the way home from that concert, he said, we just looked at each other. We're like, it's got to be done. So then we actually started going to AA. Now, we went to AA, and he went, and we started going to some different groups. And I liked groups where I could wear, where I could sit in the back and smoke and look kind of edgy. look edgy. And I'm not really ever edgy, but I wanted to look that way. And I like edgy people. But I was never really edgy. And we start going to these groups, and we go to this one group, and like everybody's like, "Hi, how are you doing?" "Oh, my name's whatever. Let me show you all the meetings we go to." And like all these guys are like surrounding us. I'm freaking out. I don't like it at all. He's just getting sucked in. Right? And some old bald guy comes up and goes, "Hi, my name's Steve, and I could be your temporary sponsor. Here, let me give you my number." And we're walking out of that meeting. I'm like, "Are you going to call that guy?" And he goes, "Yeah, I think I am." And I'm like, "Oh," I couldn't believe it. I was like, "What are you doing?" But he is like, he was going to do it. And, our sobriety date, we still own the same sobriety date as December 4th of 1987. But December 31st rolls around. And I'm working the edges of AA, all right? I have no fellowship whatsoever. And he's really hooked into a super active fellowship. So, I work a little bit in that day. I come home and I'm thinking, we're going out for New Year's Eve. And 11:30 rolls around, 12 o'clock rolls around. All those half hours roll around until about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning when he comes walking into that little shacky apartment. And I have had a really good pity party. I've had the pity party to end all pity parties, right? So much so that there were these two old bottles of vodka that were up in our cupboard that, like, they were so bad that we hadn't finished them. And I didn't drink, but I poured them out in the sink, but I tried to make it look like I probably did drink them because I wanted him to feel bad for me when he walked in, right? And he walked in, and he kind of walked in the kitchen. He goes, "Oh, I'm glad you poured those out. I've been meaning to do that." And I was like, I was not happy. And then he just read me the AA Riot Act, He goes, you know what? I had the best time tonight I've had in a long time. And I'm doing better than I've been doing in a long time, and you're not. You know, and maybe you need to start trying to do the same stuff I'm doing. You know, and he goes, this guy's going to be your sponsor. And I was like, okay. All right, and I started working the steps. That first sponsor had me do three things right off the bat, you know, and basically write three lists. The first list was regrets I had, like from my drinking and my life. The next two lists were, one was like what things I want to do kind of in the, you know, in the early time, you know, kind of in the next year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, and then things over a lifetime. So one of those first things was, you know, yeah, I'm a high school dropout, and I regret that. You know, and then, you know, for the things in the future, you know, I want to have a good job, I want to, you know, maybe go to college and do that kind of stuff. And so and he goes, okay, he goes, this list here of regrets, that's your insanity. All this other stuff, that's totally sane. There's nothing on this list that isn't reasonable for a person to be able to do in life if they're working these steps and they're actively involved in this program, you know. And so, and from that day, you know, forward, I started working on that stuff. I went to community college, and they had a program where I could get my high school diploma. I was working for, you know, getting college classes. I kind of did better and better in my work to the point that I was able to kind of, you know, have an expense account and a car and, you know, make good money. You know, I had a relationship. The first meetings I went into was a candlelight meeting. I looked across the table and I said, okay, that's the one. And I pursued her for the next 6 months until, you know, we were together. But, you know, we were together within my first year, and that sponsor was one of those, you can't be in a relationship in your first year sponsors. So I was like, well, I know if people that are in relationships and they get sober, their sponsor doesn't tell them that they need to break up with the person that they're with. So I need to get a new sponsor. You know, and so I start doing that, right? I start running my own program. Right? I get a new sponsor and I call the guy every day or whatever. We don't have a connection. You know, I start doing well. You know, I do well enough in school that this California state system says, hey, you know what? Taking too many classes at this cost. This is for people that, you know, kind of need community college. So now we're going to charge you the California state system credits for these classes. So, you know, really they're encouraging you to transfer. You know, at that point I'm like, you know what? I might as well, you know, look for really what I want to do, you know? And so I transferred to California Berkeley. Now the relationship had broken up because she stopped doing AA. And she got pretty sick. She graduated number one out of USC Law School, but she was sick. And it wasn't working, you know. And so I moved up to Northern California, and I met Julie there, who's my wife. We both had about 10 years of sobriety at this point, and we met at the Wild Bunch, which is a meeting in Berkeley. But we tell people, so that's what we tell our AA friends. We met the Wild Bunch. We tell everybody else we met at Berkeley. You know, it's true. And, you know, and we kind of started our, you know, our little voyage together. And we moved all over the country. So I did really well in school, and my faculty members were like, maybe you might want to keep doing this a little bit. You seem well fit for it. And so then we ended up going out to Iowa, and I went into a PhD program there in my field, and Julie got a master's degree in counseling, and we start having kids, all right? Now, here's the thing. I now do some research so when I got to Iowa, I was kind of floundering a little bit, and I decided, you know what, I'm gonna do what I know. And so I started focusing on Alcoholics Anonymous in my work. And it worked really well. And what my dissertation focused on was how people negotiate spiritual tensions in recovery, right? And, you know, so like when you go to a meeting, so one of the things is, in you know, people in this room have probably done it. is they've gone in, they've got up, and they've started talking, and they started talking bad about their religious experience. Right? And some of the people are like, you know what? People get up and they start talking about my religion, and they're characterizing it in a certain way, and I'm like, that's not my religion. Right? And some of the people I talked to were Native Americans who, you know, were raised in, you know, had to go through the Catholic kind of, you know, systems where they, you know, where they were trying to kind of teach the Native American out of them, you know, and how they felt when they came to AA. And some of the people said, you know what? I got something out of that, and I felt a connection with a God. You know, and I came to AA, and I can, and people look at me like I'm wrong because I, you know, because I've accepted this European perception of a higher power, but I get relief from that. But it was just everyone, you know, just tons and tons of people talking to me all of these different stories about their connection. And I started, and I continued to do, you know, some of that research and so forth. But I've also started doing research looking at kind of the different perceptions of alcoholism, you know, the medical perception and the psychological perception and the spiritual perception and the social perception. And in some of that, you know, the more current research. So when, you know, Silkworth talks to Bill Wilson, when Bill Wilson's having no success, he's like, dude, you've got to stop preaching to these people. It's not working. And he goes, give them the hard medical facts, drill that stuff home. And we, and our hard medical facts are a little bit more acute now. Now, I will tell you that genetically, the stuff that they've been, the markers they've been able to identify that, hey, people, these things seem to be pretty clear markers with people who have, with a certain group of people who have alcoholism. Those genetic markers, basically what's associated with those is being anxious, irritable, and depressed, right? Restless, irritable, and discontented. It's the same thing that Silkworth said. It's the same thing, whether we talk about it from the sense of genetics or we talk about it from the sense of perception of what we look like. And we had kids, right? We had kids. And everybody in my immediate family, right, suffers from this disease, died from this disease, or is in recovery from this disease, right? When in 2009, my brother and I both got a phone call, and we had to go to Los Angeles, and we had to clean out my dead dad's apartment, right? He died from this disease. My mom has 40-plus years of sobriety now, right? My brother and I both have 36 years of sobriety, and... and my 20-year-old son has 5 years. And I have another child who suffers. Doesn't suffer from... addresses the restless, irritable, and discontented part from something that doesn't, that we don't identify with, right? Neither our sister program that starts with an N or ours chose something else, right? But the physical implications of that are getting to the point now that, you know, would be the same thing that we would consider to be like cirrhosis of the liver, but just a different version, all right? You know, and, you know, with my son, he, the way he ended up getting sober is my brother was having a birthday party. It was probably his 54th birthday, and we have AA events. That's what you do when you're a Thatcher, right? And so he was having this AA party, and the kids were there with us, and one of my friend, one of my, some guy who was a young guy at the time was talking to my son, said, hey, I like to do climbing. My son's like, I like to do climbing too. He goes, you want to go climbing? He says, yeah, let's go climbing. You know, and they go to a rock thing, and they start talking, and the guy starts kind of asking him questions, like, well, how much do you drink, and all this type of stuff, and he goes, well, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? He goes, yeah. He goes, well, what about, you know, where are you at with, like, your higher power? And he goes, well, my son's like, I believe in God or whatever, and he comes home with a notebook and a book, He's like, I guess I'm an AA now. You know, and you know, and he's done the deal, and he's done the deal, and you know, when he tells a story, he tells a story, and it's like he's an alcoholic. I mean, he, you know, he OD'd and he did all that stuff that we do, right? You know, the kids now, their entry level stuff is, you know, it's pretty intense. He was doing the same stuff that my dad died from. So you know, and you know. I want to talk a little bit about Kenny now. The reason I started working with Kenny, so I want to finish it up with Kenny because he's the person who's supposed to be here, right? And, you know, I had done a lot of stuff. I had been connected in AA. I published about AA. I did a lot of stuff with AA. I don't have time to, like, look it up and read it. But in one of the readings, like, right after Bill writes his, you know, famous emotional sobriety reading, He talks about kind of the problem sometimes is God as we understand him. You know what? I'm going to see if I can pull it up real quick because it's really good. It explicitly expresses exactly where I was. In lots of instances, I think that people find their first great obstacle in the phrase God as we understand him. The doubter is apt to say, on the face of it, nobody can understand God. I half believe that there is a first cause, a something, and maybe a somebody, but I can't get any further than this. I think people are kidding themselves when they say they can. Even if there were a somebody, why should he bother with little me when in making the cosmos run, he already has plenty to do? As for those folks who claim that God tells them where to drill for oil or when to brush their teeth, well, they just make me tired, all right? Our friend is clearly one who believes in some kind of God, God as he understands him, but he doesn't believe any bigger concept or better feeling about God to be possible. So he looks upon meditation, prayer, and guidance as the means of self-delusion. And I was exactly there, you know? I was exactly there. I really knew AA, but I had no real deep relationship with the higher power. You know, to the point that it meant anything. I prayed and meditated, but it wasn't really any depth at all, right? And, you know, and I started hearing some people talk about this guy, Kenny, and two different people said, you know, well, Kenny said the loving thing to do would be this. Now, Kenny's woo-woo, right? And I was like, okay, you know, but then I started thinking, you know what? One of the things I realized is, like, people didn't want me to sponsor them. They weren't all that interested in having what I had. I thought they should want what I had, but they didn't weren't all that interested, right? So I said, I'm gonna start talking to this guy. And we started doing, we went right back through the book from page number one, and then we started reading some other stuff. And he asked me this one question one time. He said, what do you think would happen if you stopped putting limitations on your higher power? And that was the thing that opened the gates, all right? And, you know, from that point forward, you know, it's like, you know, I had to come to the point of, like, I have to believe in a providential higher power that cares about me, you know, that cares about me. And I have to be able to start looking and seeing God in all of your faces. And I had to start really having a deep desire. And guess what? People want me to sponsor them. Like, my book is full. And there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing I can point to. You know, there's a direct cause and effect timing relationship, right? From changing that one thing. I'm still active in the program. You know, my commitment at Magnolia Speakers Meeting as a treasurer, that's a crappy commitment. You know, but, you know, there wasn't anybody else to take it. You know, I do a lot of other service. I would like to, there's a box back there for doing service at institution, at a prison. I'd recommend anybody who hasn't done that kind of service, who's eligible to do it, do that service. You know, I've done a lot of that service. And I'll finish up, thank you. I'll finish up with one thing. So, my wife and I were asked to speak at the first AA conference in a maximum security prison. and it was in Soledad, in California. And, you know, a group of us, they go in, they, you know, frisk us every day and check us and all that stuff, and we go in and we do this thing. There was like 300 guys there from this prison at this conference. The first guy I start talking to, I'm like, okay, where are you from? And he's like, starts talking. I'm like, oh, I used to work there. And he goes, oh, really? Where'd you work? And we worked at the same place. And he embezzled from that place. That's how he ended up in jail. And he worked, and he, you know, he said, you know, I need to make an amends to you because this is what happened. You know, and, you know, and it was like, wow, like I had to come to this prison. I was living in Seattle at the time. I had to come to California to go to a prison to actually have somebody who I actually had some engagement with. It wasn't my brother who was in sobriety. And then later on we were walking people through a four step, and somebody said, okay, and then we were doing eight step stuff and walking people through, okay, well, this is what you would do with amends, and we were paired one-on-one, and I sit down with the guy, and he starts talking, and I'm like, I know who you're talking about. She's my friend. And it's that point of connection that we have. You know, it's that place that we make in connections with other people. This program has saved the lives of everyone who's closest to me, you know. And I just really want to thank everyone for listening to me and inviting me down here. And I hope you have a great rest of the conference. Thank you.